Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arcanal.
How's it going, everybody?
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 9th, 2024. So Lee, what do you have for us today?
Well, first up, I have a public service announcement from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, here in the United States, titled North Korea Aggressively Targeting Crypto Industry with Well-Disguised Social Engineering Attacks. Now, we know North Korea, if you know North Korea or have listened to us in the past or any other podcast, really, you know this is nothing new from North Korea or the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, because they're always targeting financial institutions. And the reason for that goes back to the political aspect of it, that we don't trade with them. They're embargoed heavily. There's very little money going in there from Western civilization. So they always turn to financially motivated crime. Granted, they have been successful in the past. If you think about the Bangladesh bank heist back in 2016, they actually got away with $81 million U.S. dollars. So they're getting good at it. And just like any other nation state, if you focus on it, they're going to have their best people and they're going to spend all their time and effort there conducting these attacks and being successful. And it really shows with this announcement from the FBI, because they mention a couple things from North Korea's arsenal. It's not really tools. It's more the people problem. It's people researching, doing their research, finding their targets, spending the time to build that trust between the victims before they eventually exploit them. They touch on that they conduct extensive pre-operational research. The scenarios or the engineering itself is individualized. So they do take time to craft a likable personality that may be somehow related or know someone in the other person's circle. So they're already building on the trust there. Or they impersonate some people. They may be taking advantage of, some names that are not famous, but well-known in the tech community, crypto community, and so on. Whether it be a true influencer, or maybe someone who is just likes to talk finance or cryptocurrency as well, they learn or they take the time, talk to these people, and really build that trust and rapport. Now, doing all that, still, at the same time, you can still protect yourself. And FBI did highlight some indicators, like if someone requests to execute code or download applications on your company device, maybe that's not the best place to do it. I mean, if you are going to, or if you think about if you're taking job employment or looking for jobs elsewhere, normally you wouldn't be conducting that on a company device anyways. So if someone explicitly asks you to run this on your company device, it might be a red flag. Also, if they mention pre-employment tests or debugging exercises that involve executing non-standard or unknown Node.js packages, Python, offers of employment from prominent cryptocurrency or technology firms, investment opportunities, and so on. So all these things that kind of come out of nowhere. Even if you did build a rapport or relationship with this person, if all of a sudden they have all these hey, here's an easy way in kind of thing, it might, trust your gut, go back to the mentality of if it's too good to be true, it probably is. They do have some mitigations. This is do not store information about cryptocurrency wallets on internet connected devices. Avoid taking pre-employment tests or executing code on company laptops again. Use 2FA, limit access to sensitive network documentation, and so on. But it's a great quick tip from the FBI about this, because come to think about it, as I was reading this, there have been some opportunities where people have reached out to me over LinkedIn, mentioning either people in my circle or current employment, say, hey, this person liked the idea of this. Maybe you should try and check this out as well. And you're like, oh, that actually sounds like a fun opportunity. But it was so cleverly disguised, or even if it was legitimate, it was just one of those things that you think about. You're like, well, I don't know this person. What is this we're even talking about? Should I, you know, follow up on this? Or should I do some research and figure out who's asking me about this and so on? But pretty interesting article, especially, you know, if you are looking for like threat hunting tips, though, you know, go MITRE ATT&CK Matrix, look at North Korea's old or their old attacks, find their behaviors and so on. But watch out for these social engineering lures. So what was your thoughts?
So, yeah, you talked about the amount of effort they put into kind of building rapport and the social engineering aspect. And it's interesting because, you know, when we think like, oh, it's driven by nation state, you know, there must have some edge or advantage or something like that. And, you know, I was just kind of thinking through, even when I was looking at this specific report, is it just like our normal human nature? Like, if you remember, like when you meet new people and you're trying to like how to have that first conversation, or when you're younger and you're trying to court somebody that you're interested in, you know, you're trying to find that common ground or those certain circumstances where you can put you in the same room with them, right? It's the same idea that they're basically leveraging, just, you know, be it through, you know, technology and things like that for communications. And so what I always think about, even when like I enjoy my contacts with LinkedIn, I've had some really great conversations with, I would say somewhat random people that we just connected based on common interests. And when someone like immediately reaches out after I accept the connection, and things like that, I always kind of go through the process. Not that like, can I have this conversation, but how genuine is it? Because, you know, there's a lot of times where we've had, or I'm sure people have been in those situations where it's small talk is small talk. You know, you can talk about the weather, you can talk about sports, you can talk about whatever common things that usually come up in those conversations. But I'm always kind of thinking about, now, is this a genuine conversation? Like, are they really interested in this? Like, do they show any signs of that? Or is it just, how do we keep the conversation going? How do we make sure the moment's not awkward? Like, what is some of the motivations behind some of those things? So I don't really have the best tricks, but when I think about, is this genuine, or I ask myself that question, sometimes it helps me pick up on weird behaviors when having like a genuine conversation. So there's a little bit of that aspect. And the other thing is, it sounds like, you know, I was just actually doing research on North Korea doing some other social engineering where they were trying to basically do a lot of this stuff, but it was a while back. Well, I guess this was reported in 2023 for some of these things. So it might have overlapped with the same campaign they were doing, but they were basically trying to do those interviews for jobs, and they had a Trojanized version of the video conferencing software they wanted to use. They would send to someone and have them run, and then it would fail, or they try to help them troubleshoot it, or it would basically launch something else as a backdoor on their machine. And so, and, you know, I was trying to think, well, how would I defend against something like that? One, just, you know, kind of the guidelines and policies, like, yeah, like you were saying before, don't run other stuff that people tell you to run that you don't really know who they are, or, you know, yeah, you just shouldn't have to run things. They need to revisit on, okay, let's find another way to communicate that you can control. Or I was even thinking, does it even make sense when people do outside interviews, especially I've seen more and more attacks that are around job interviews, not just the phishing to get someone to open an application, but the actual try to get someone through the door or enough access to now they're kind of like that espionage component where you just have like a virtual infrastructure for doing or conducting interviews. So it doesn't really matter what you do on the machine. It's just something that gets wiped and washed away. But I don't know how often people would need to log in, because then you wouldn't even have to use your real credentials on the machine either. It could just be like interview credentials. So you'd have less risk that way. Whether or not that would justify the investment, but if you already have the investment for those things in place, I don't think the cost would be much to have a couple kind of VDI setups that would let you do that if it makes sense. So that was kind of a random thought that may not be the best solution, but just kind of came to mind as, well, this could work. So so yeah, that was kind of my additional thoughts.
Yeah, especially, you know, one thing that, like, if that thing pops up that says, hey, do you really want to run this? Or, hey, you need administrative rights to run this? Maybe don't be doing that.
Yeah.
But it is a shame that they are It sounds like they're taking advantage of people's vulnerabilities, right? I mean, not social engineering already is a vulnerability problem, but if you're looking for a job and someone's like, hey, I got this great opportunity for you, you're kind of, you know, if you are in the right mindset, if you are in a bad mindset and you're like, man, I really need to get out of this current position, then, I mean, it's unfortunate. Just be vigilant.
Yep. Like I said, I don't know how to test for genuine, but I think we all have kind of built in, does this sound genuine, kind of radars in us. So,
yeah. All right. Well, enough about that. What you got?
So this one I thought was interesting. It was just a report from Cybersecurity News or Security Online .info, but the report or the article is "Beware the Drive-By Download: Luma C2 Sealer and Malicious Chrome Extension Wreak Havoc." And it just kind of didn't go into too much technical detail other than some of the capability stuff. But the eSentire's threat response unit basically saw this malware campaign. It was leveraging DLL sideloading, which we've seen a lot of, and that distributed the Luma C2 Stealer and the malicious Chrome extension. And what was interesting is usually this is done by kind of a drive-by download where you might land on a page that pulls things down. And in this case, downloading a malicious zip file that has an installer associated with it. Now, what's interesting with, I think, DLL sideloading, I think you see that a lot in these cases where you actually have a zip or RAR, some sort of archive that actually has the legitimate installer or EXE and the malicious DLL together, because you usually have to have more than one file. So they seem to be moved that way a lot with the archivers. So just like be aware when you see those, DLL sideloading might be the justification for that. But you know, they talked about the Luma Stealer, which gives them kind of like the C2, lets them move other payloads in. But then they talk about what the actual extension offers. And it's, you know, it goes beyond just looking at financial data. It actually looks at all the hardware specifics and the system information. And then it also will monitor specific URLs. So, and then potentially intercept or leverage some of the 2FA that people may use, either being sent to their email or other means. But the other thing that really stood out, I thought this was kind of ingenious from the browser extension, was they also included Cursed Chrome, which is basically like a implant in your browser that lets them basically use your browser as a proxy. So they can like proxy through you to browse. And what's significant of that is if you're like me and never close anything out, when it comes to tabs and things you may be logged into, if there are sessions that are live or active, now they don't even have to steal credentials or things, or, you know, have to figure out how to trick into two-factor to gain that access. If you have logged in and have a session that is at least active enough, they can basically proxy through your browser to gain access to that source. So that is interesting as well. And, you know, something to note, well, a lot of these, it didn't mention this article, but just kind of a tidbit to pay attention to, how a lot of these malicious extensions are leveraged. There is a registry key that's in the software policies Google Chrome extension install force list, which can kind of force the install of an extension that you kind of register there. And you can put a path to it if it's even externally hosted to the URL of that extension. Or you can even on the target, on the shortcut file for the Chrome execution that you see, there's the like, target file field. It usually points to the executable in your system that the shortcut points to. You can actually add arguments there to launch when that will basically be taken into account when you launch Chrome. And the argument there is a --, load --, extension with a path to the extension. And then you can even have args that go to the path of the file if it's a local file. That will basically force Chrome when launched from your typical shortcut that you use to open it to load that extension every time for like a persistence piece. Because we've been seeing a lot of malicious Chrome extensions, at least, I mean, I'm going to say in the past few weeks. From just doing this podcast, we always seem to have an article related to that, and they're not talking about the same attack, same campaign, or maybe even the same actors. So Yeah, I just thought it was some newer capabilities that are kind of being thrown in the mix that I haven't seen yet. So what do you think?
So it was pretty interesting. Seeing Chrome extensions being abused is something that seems to be more and more common, especially because, you know, all the credentials and passwords and sensitive information people are continuing to save in their browser, which, I mean, I have some stuff, but it's kind of like low rem, right? It's not tied to any bank accounts or anything like that, which are sort of isolated as well. And you mentioned the whole that you don't like to close tabs. It reminded me of the browser extension that actually counts your the tabs or how many.
Oh, yeah.
Tabs you have open. That made me laugh. But this was a really good, wrap up. And I'm going to actually kind of take a step back from the technical piece of it because I thought it was very interesting. You explained it better than I could have, but I really like the breakdown of the article, the structure of it. I like the fact that they called out, they said, what can you learn from this true positive, this TRU positive, because they're the AcentIR's threat response unit. Nice play on words. But they provide you with information, like not just intel. It's actionable intelligence now, because it's like, what can you learn from this? It tells you the malware capabilities, the, you know, things that you can look for, behaviors you can look for, like technical details that you can actually make actionable, take into your environment. Then they make some recommendations. Like, hey, check that your EDR is working, or that it detects this, or that you have visibility, which is a huge problem for a lot of organizations. Talks about phishing security awareness training, of course. I mean, we're coming up to October, so it's going to be that month. And then one thing I found really, really interesting was it says, we recommend modifying the default OpenWith settings for script files to ensure they open with a basic text editor like Notepad instead of executing.
Yeah.
That was really neat. Like the fact that they would recommend someone do that, and that, I mean, that would be like something that you could notice or a user could be aware of now instead of something just happening. You know, I click this link, blah, blah, blah. If Notepad pops up with a bunch of nonsense in front of someone, train them to say, hey, contact the help desk and we can see what's going on. But this was a really good article. And those recommendations and the lessons learned, I thought was a neat aspect as well.
Cool. What do you got for us next?
So next up I found it in the Register, but I pivoted to the linked article by the Citizen Lab. This was dated August 14th, a little dated, but still really interesting. I mean, it's less than a month if you consider that dated. But they saw a spear phishing campaign that was targeting Western and Russian civilian society, so non-government people. And at first, I was like, oh, surprise, you know, Russia's targeting groups. But as I read, it's more talking about how they are targeting NGOs or non-government organizations, specifically the Free Russia Foundation, which, yeah, at the same time, like, you kind of forget that Russia, from a political perspective, may be doing some wrong things. But from a, you know, thing about the people that actually live there, you know, some people are, you know, trying to make changes. But, you know, sometimes I forget that until I come across an article like this. But they were targeting a lot of these people. And they said the publisher of, and I'll probably pronounce this wrong, Proect Media, Proekt. Her name is Polina Machold or Machold. You know, once again, using similar tactics to what we discussed with North Korea, how they're masquerading as people who know her. So, you know, reaching out to people who may agree with her and so on. Using these, but instead of looking for cybersecurity or cryptocurrency, you know, it sounds like they're trying to leak a bunch of data. And you think, well, why would they want to leak data just from these organizations that, you know, aren't really, you know, bad? If they're just non-government organizations, what are we thinking about? It kind of dawned on me. I'm reading it from the Citizen Lab. And in the past, Citizen Lab has done a lot of protecting journalists, government dissidents, so people who live in countries and are speaking out and they don't agree with it, but in countries that don't appreciate that or don't allow that, it had just hit me. I was like, oh, they're leaking these names because, or names and information, sounds like they're pretty much doxing them to the public. And if all of a sudden you know all this information and you're a government that is looking for targets like this, you know, there's ways that you can really leverage that information, whether it be from a perspective of, we'll keep an eye on them, maybe we'll send them some, you know, PDFs that, in, you know, contain malicious code so that we can spy on the person. Or what if we start using their persona to talk to fellow people and, you know, compromise their machines and, you know, kind of spread that and see who they're all associating with? It was pretty interesting read. I mean, or it was called the Rivers of Fish because the threat group name was Cold River, also known as Star Blizzard, Callisto, and some other stuff. But it all just like seemed to be PDF driven. They talk about, and this was a huge article, and I'm trying to hit all the highlights, but they're talking about the indicators, the TTPs, how it's all pulled back to this one organization and so on. But once again, looking at governments targeting their own people, it's kind of just I don't know even what word to use to describe it other than unfortunate. But yeah, I know there's not a lot of technical details there and there's not much hunting involved. But once again, just the fact that, you know, be aware, be, you know, cognizant of who's reaching out to you, who may be talking. And I will say the one thing that cracked me up was looking at the register in the top, or in my tab that it's open. The title is Kremlin's Cyber Nerds Broke In and Leaked NGO Inboxes. Someone's spreading that information, but you only see that in the tab, which I thought was fine. But yeah, some unfortunate things going on. But once again, be aware, be vigilant, check your email, don't execute anything that you need, or that you're not expecting, and so on.
Yeah, I think it's a great thought piece when you try to look at, I think what cyber highlights the most, just because I guess we work in the field, so we kind of track that news cycle a lot more than, you know, maybe some other people that just follow more mainstream news. You can really get a feel for what are the values of a country when you see what they do to their own people, or what they try to break it into. Like, you know, when you see the cyber capabilities of a government going after big business, their businesses within their own country borders, within all that kind of, it says a lot as far as the control aspect. And in this case, it looks like, you know, if there's these groups that are kind of, I don't want to say necessarily anti-government, because it seems more for the people, but sometimes they can, you know, they can be spins that way where they're radical, where then you could justify government interventions and things like that. But it looks like it was really to gather a lot of information, possibly understand where their stories and information are coming from. What are they going to come out with next? Kind of be ahead of the game, essentially, depending on what these groups' next moves and things might be. But it's just always interesting when you do see this, because it's not something that usually hits mainstream news when you see where governments are meddling in this way. But obviously we see it more and more based on what we do. So it's just, it's a good thing to understand, like I said, the modus operandum of what governments think are important.
Yeah. And I mean, really, you can think about anyone's can be a target, which is even more unfortunate.
Yeah. And some of the sophistication there was just, you know, like locked PDFs that really were just credential harvesting sites, you know? So it's like, yeah, those are really hard from even a defender perspective capture, you know, like something that's going to lead you to a site that, other than the site's reputation, if it's a net new site, it's really hard to pick up on, oh, this site's here just to capture credentials, unless you actually go and view the site. And sometimes, I don't know the case here, but actors can be smart to where if you don't get referred the right way, you won't see the same thing even when you're doing the investigation. So, you know, there's a lot of things to take into account that makes that attack go under the radar, I think, more often than others. So the next or last one I wanted to really hit on was interesting. Still kind of at the topic, we're talking about the Russian area in general, but this is more about Russia and Belarus being the victim. So it's a Secure List article, which I think is, you know, Kapersky is kind of the owner of this space, but it's titled Head Mayor, Adventures of a Unicorn in Russia and Belarus. So Belarus and Russia, if you're not familiar with just even the ties there, I look at Belarus as like Russia's little brother. They are a separate country, but they are heavily influenced by what Russia would like them to do. So there's a lot of leaning on each other. So they do get bundled together when you see any kind of, in this case, cyber attack. You know, it makes sense why to attack both. Kind of seen sometimes in the same entity. But this runs through kind of what were the tools and attacks that actually happened by this group. And it's a hacktivist group. So they're kind of going after your typical targets you would see if you're more targeting the country than other things, which is like government institutions, the transportation, energy, manufacturing, and then some entertainment stuff. Because if you can sow some civil disrupt, if you can basically make people unhappy, the government gets to hear about it too. Their approach was really just some phishing campaigns. This started with RAR archives that were vulnerable. So there was a vulnerability in 2023 that allowed you to basically execute code in addition to what was actually in the archive. So they leveraged that. And then they also did some ransomware. And what was interesting, the ransomware is that they picked, because obviously they're not Lockbit and they're not Babook, if I'm saying that correctly. But there were leaked versions of Lockbit, I want to say, at Builder in like 2022. And Babook's been leaked a long time ago, because that's where all the Linux ESXi code for ransomware originated from. And it's now starting to change. You see slight different variations. But for the longest time, when you would see ransomware, they would touch the ESXi infrastructure. You knew that's where they got a lot of that code from. So it was much easier to identify that way. So they did that for the ransomware stuff, but they also used Phantom DL and Phantom Core. And these were interesting because obviously it's tied back to Ukraine. So when you say hacktivists, you know, Russia and Belarus involved. Now, you know, that might have some Ukrainian play in there, because that was a Ukrainian group that I think was dubbed Phantom Core, if I remember, a while back. But they use what they called Phantom Wrap, but I'm assuming the Phantom DL and Phantom Core are tied to those two things. And they also used another C2 framework, Sliver, which is on the open source side. They use Ngrokht and RSocks done to do some tunneling. Zenall Password Pro, which I'm assuming is a way to extract passwords, and Mimikatz. So common kind of off-the-shelf toolkits, what you would expect to see from a hacktivist group, but also you can see how it's still effective. These basic things are. And then what I loved is, you know, they didn't do anything too crazy. And then the persistence is, and this is what I also like too, you see persistence leveraged by these nation states. And it's the same as the same persistence the hacktivists are using against them. The irony there always kind of, you know, this is why we hunt for things, right? Doesn't matter really who's involved. People are using the same techniques because they're effective, which means they're easier to spend time in identifying those and being successful. So in this case, standard run keys, right? They have some run keys that they set up. I think three different types of run keys. And then they would have two different types of scheduled tasks that go based on when a user logs in and so forth. What was also interesting, though, is if you look at the samples, especially for the Phantom DL and the Phantom Core, they obviously were business documents. But if you look at the naming convention, something I don't think they called out the double extension. They didn't call out the leading space. So in this case, when I say double extensions, they look like .pdf, but .exe. And so that was a way so that maybe they might look, especially if you have extensions not visible on and you're on a Windows machine, you'll just see the .pdf as if that was the extension, and it would kind of be deceiving, right? But the space before the .exe, and if I remember, and this is kind of reaching back on previous knowledge, email gateways, when you would see an attachment in the email, and sometimes when you displayed it, especially in your client or your browser, if there's a space before the .exe, you won't see the .exe as the attachment file. You'll just see whatever it is before that. So it's a way to kind of trick how it's displayed. And it looks like obviously they're using This is a social engineering if they're already including the PDF extension. So there was a kind of a way, I think, twofold to trick people as things are being sent in from the social engineering perspective, which just means that if this is a common technique to hide things in general, it may be worth even just looking for the space.exe or other file types for executables where there's that leading space, because that's just not normal, I think, human behavior in general to have a space before the extension. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. So that was another thing that stood out. And they kind of roll through the lists of some executables and IOCs and things. But those are kind of the main things I wanted to call out and give you a chance to see what was interesting to you as well.
Yeah, like you said, same old, persistence was gained through the registry run keys or a scheduled task. Both versions look like they're trying to mask, or they were masquerading as well. So not only were they referencing the executables and the registry keys, but they're naming the keys something that may pass off as legitimate if you just glance over it.
But the path was app data, though. So a lot of the masquerading, just to call out, usually you see those in system directories and things or programs that are legitimate programs when you see things from app data in a registry run key. Or, yeah, I think the pathing is how you help get around the masquerading problem.
Yeah, that contextualization is extremely important. But yeah, looking at the Microsoft update core name, the registry key name, and the scheduled task at the same time, yeah, there are things you can notice, but they were on log on. Then they found lockbit samples that used OneDrive.exe and VLC.exe. They were rocking in different directories as well. The fact that Mimikatz is still listed is blowing my mind.
So many ways to run it now. It's just become same thing, run so many different ways.
I had to Google it, and the first version was released in 2011. And here we are, still seeing that listed as one of the most successful or as a tool. But yeah, the list of open source software or tools that were used as well. That's a bigger problem. Yeah, I think we've discussed that in length multiple times. But once again, great report, full of actionable information. I think you said it, the behaviors remain the same. Using those registry keys and using those scheduled tasks to gain persistence, and will continue to happen, until we stop it or kill that capability. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that's what I, when we say these things are common, that is the benefit or the challenge is everyone has to use the same systems. Like when people say we're attacking computers, it's not as simple as that. We're attacking Windows, which runs a certain way, or we're attacking Linux. And so there's your guardrails, and there's certain things that are built in. And there's some things that are undocumented that you might come across and maybe utilize, but unless you have all the time in the world and the resources, you're going to fall back on what works and how things are designed. So, yeah.
And like you said before, that's why we hunt. Look for these common behaviors.
Yeah, pretty much. So, yeah, that was the last thing I wanted to mention from the article side. I did want to do one announcement. Obviously, you got the Threat Hunt Workshop, Hunting for Collections, happening October 2nd, 2024. That'll be 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It'll be you and Jorge Rodriguez. I know you guys did one last time together, and it went really well. I don't know if you want to say anything additional there, but that should be a good thing to look forward to.
Yes, as always, we're going to have some fun. We're going to discuss a MITRE tactic, how we can take a look at it, how we can hunt for it. And of course, we're using some hunt packages from the Hunter platform to lead the way. And then once we find the artifacts, we're going to do what we normally do, and we're going to pivot in the data. We're going to use the Elastic SIM. And if you register, you'll get all the tools needed to learn or test your threat hunting skills. And of course, there's going to be a flag that if you answer correctly and submit, you will get your collection badge.
It's always a good time. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that will close out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 9th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, Check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.